to the tune of the New Year's song, Auld Lang Syne. It goes, "We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here." Her pitch rose through the first half like a deep breath in, and then she sang it back down. "We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here." Even though I was supposed to be basically grown up, and my mother annoyed the hell out of me, I couldn't stop thinking until her lullaby finally put me to sleep. 13. Despite my having psychologically decompensated in his presence, Davis texted me the next morning before I even got out of bed. Him.
"Want to watch a movie tonight? Doesn't even have to be set in space."
Me. "I can't. Another time, maybe. Sorry I freaked out and for the sweating and everything." Him.
"You don't even sweat an unnormal amount."
Me. "I definitely do, but I don't want to talk about it." Him.
"You really don't like your body."
Me. "True." Him.
"I like it. It's a good body."
I enjoyed being with him more in this non-physical space, but I also felt the need to board up the windows of myself. Me. "I feel kinda precarious in general, and I can't really date you. Or date anyone. I'm sorry, but I can't. I like you, but I can't date you." Him.
"We agree on that. Too much work. All people in relationships ever do is talk about their relationship status. It's like a Ferris wheel."
Me.
"Huh?"
Him.
"When you're on a Ferris wheel, all anyone ever talks about is being on the Ferris wheel and the view from the Ferris wheel and whether the Ferris wheel is scary and how many more times it will go around. Dating is like that. Nobody who's doing it ever talks about anything else. I have no interest in dating."
Me. "Well, what do you have an interest in?" Him.
"You."
Me. I don't know how to respond to that. Him.
"You don't need to. Have a good day, Aza."
Me. "You too, Davis." I had an appointment with Dr. Karen Singh the next day after school. I sat on the love seat across from her and looked up at that picture of a man holding a net. I stared at the picture while we talked, because the relentlessness of Dr. Singh's eye contact was a little much for me.
"How have you been?"
"Not great."
"What's going on?"
she asked. In my peripheral vision, I could see her legs crossed, black short-heeled shoes, her foot tapping in the air. "There's this boy," I said.
"And?"
"I don't know. He's cute and smart, and I like him. But I'm not getting any better, and I just feel like if this can't make me happy, then what can?"
"I don't know. What can?"
I groaned. "That's such a psychiatrist move."
"Point taken. A change in personal circumstances, even a positive one, can trigger anxiety. So it wouldn't be uncommon to feel anxious as you develop a new relationship. Where are you with the intrusive thoughts?"
"Well, yesterday I was making out with him and had to stop everything because I couldn't stop thinking about how gross it was, so not great."
"About how gross what was?"
"Just how his tongue has its own particular microbiome, and once he sticks his tongue in my mouth, his bacteria become part of my microbiome for literally the rest of my life. Like, his tongue will sort of always be in my mouth until I'm dead, and then his tongue microbes will eat my corpse."
"And that made you want to stop kissing him?"
"Well, yeah," I said.
"That's not uncommon. So part of you wanted to be kissing him, And another part of you felt the intense worry that comes with being intimate with someone.
Right, but I wasn't worried about intimacy. I was worried about microbial exchange.
Well, your worry expressed itself as being about microbial exchange.
I just groaned at the therapy bullshit. She asked me if I'd taken my Ativan. I told her I hadn't brought it to Davis's house. And then she asked me if I was taking the Lexapro every day, and I was like, not every day. The conversation devolved into her telling me that medication only works if you take it, and that I had to treat my health problem with consistency and care, and me trying to explain that there is something intensely weird and upsetting about the notion that you can only become yourself by ingesting a medication that changes yourself. When the conversation paused for a moment, I asked, "Why'd you put up that picture? Of that guy with the netting?"
"What aren't you saying? What are you scared to say, Aza?"
I thought about the real question, the one that remained constantly in the background of my consciousness like a ringing in the ears. I was embarrassed of it, but also I felt like saying it might be dangerous somehow. Like how you don't ever say Voldemort's name. "I think I might be a fiction," I said.
"How's that?"
"Like, you say it's stressful to have a change in circumstances, right?" She nodded. "But what I want to know is there a you independent of circumstances? Is there a way down deep me who is an actual real person, the same person if she has money or not, the same person if she has a boyfriend or not, the same if she goes to this school or that school? Or am I only a set of circumstances?"
"I don't follow how that would make you fictional."
"I mean, I don't control my thoughts, so they're not really mine. I don't decide if I'm sweating or get cancer or C. diff or whatever, so my body isn't really mine. I don't decide any of that. Outside forces do. I'm a story they're telling. I am circumstances." She nodded.
"Can you apprehend these outside forces?"
"No, I'm not hallucinating," I said. "It's like I'm just not sure that I am, strictly speaking, real." Dr. Singh placed her feet on the floor and leaned forward, her hands on her knees.
"That's very interesting," she said. "Very interesting."
I felt briefly proud to be, for a moment anyway, not uncommon.
"It must be very scary to feel that yourself might not be yours. Almost a kind of imprisonment?"
I nodded.
"There's a moment," she said, "near the end of Ulysses, when the character Molly Bloom appears to speak directly to the author. She says, 'Oh, Jamesy, let me up out of this.' You're imprisoned within a self that doesn't feel wholly yours, like Molly Bloom. But also, to you, that self often feels deeply contaminated."
I nodded.
"But you give your thoughts too much power, Aza. Thoughts are only thoughts. They are not you. You do belong to yourself, even when your thoughts don't."
"But your thoughts are you. I think, therefore, I am, right?"
"No, not really. A fuller formation of Descartes' philosophy would be dubito ergo cogito ergo sum. I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I am. Descartes wanted to know if you could really know that anything was real. But he believed his ability to doubt reality proved that, while it might not be real, he was. You are as real as anyone. And your doubts make you more real, not less."
The moment I got back home, I could feel Mom's nerves jangling about my visit with Dr. Singh, even though she was trying to be calm and normal.
"How was it?"
she asked, not looking back at me while grading tests on the couch.
"Good, I guess," I said. "I want to apologize again for the way I spoke to Davis yesterday," she said. "You have every right to be upset with me."
"I'm not,"
I said. But I want you to be cautious, Asa. I can tell your anxiety is increasing, from your face to your fingertip.
I balled up my hand and said,
It's not him.
What is it, then?
There's no reason, I said, and turned on the TV.
But she took the remote and muted it.
You seemed locked inside of your mind, and I can't know what's going on in there, and it scares me.
I pressed my thumbnail against my fingertip through the Band-Aid, thinking it would scare her a lot more if she could see what was going on in there.
I'm fine, really.
But you're not.
Mom, tell me what to say, seriously. Just tell me what words I can say to make you calm down about it.
I don't want to calm down. I want you to stop being in pain.
Well, that's not how it works, okay?
I have to go read for history.
I stood up, but before I could get to my room, she said,
Speaking of which, Mr. Myers told me today that your essay on the Columbian Exchange was the best he'd seen in all his years of teaching.
He's been teaching like 2 years, I said.
Four.
But still, she said,
You're going places, Asa Holmes. Big places.
Did you ever hear of Amherst?
I asked. Where?
Amherst. It's this college in Massachusetts. It's really good. It's ranked really high. I think I might want to go there. If I get in.
Mom started to say something, but swallowed it, and then sighed.
We'll just have to see where the scholarships come from.
Or Sarah Lawrence, I said. That one seems good, too.
Well, remember, Asa, a lot of those schools charge you just to apply, so we have to be selective. The whole process is rigged from start to finish. They make you pay to find out you can't afford to go. We need to be realistic, and realistically, you're going to be close to home, okay? And not only because of money. I don't think you really want to be halfway across the country from everything you know.
Yeah, I said.
Okay, I get it. You don't want to talk to your mother. I love you anyway.
She blew me a kiss, and at last I escaped to my room.
I did have to read for history. But after I finished, I wasn't tired, and I kept thinking about texting Davis. I knew what I wanted to write, or at least what I was thinking about writing. I couldn't stop thinking about the text, writing it out, hitting send knowing I couldn't take it back. The sweaty heart race of waiting for a reply. I turned off my light, rolled over onto my side, and shut my eyes. But I couldn't shake the thought, so I reached over for my phone, clicked it awake, and wrote him. When you said before that you like my body, what did you mean? I watched the screen for a few seconds, waiting for the dot, dot, dot of his reply to appear. But it didn't, so I put the phone back onto the bedside table. My brain was quiet now that I'd done the thing it wanted me to do, and I was nearly asleep when I heard the phone vibrate. Him.
I mean, I like it.
Me. What about it? Him.
I like the way your shoulders slope down into your collarbone.
Him.
And I like your legs. I like the curve of your calf.
Him.
I like your hands. I like your long fingers and the insides of your wrists, the color of the skin there, the veins underneath it.
Me. I like your arms. Him.
They're skinny.
Me. They feel strong, actually. Is this okay? Him.
Very.
Me. So, the curve of my calf? I never noticed it. Him.
It's nice.
Me. Is that it? Him.
I like your ass. I really, really like your ass. Is this okay?
Me. Yes. Him.
I want to start a fan blog about your ass. Me.
Okay, that's a little weird.
Him. I want to write fan fiction in which your amazing butt falls in love with your beautiful eyes. Me.
LOL, you are really ruining the moment. You were saying before?
Him. That I like your body. I like your stomach and your legs and your hair, and I like your body. Me.
Really?
Him. Really. Me.
What is wrong with me that texting is fun and kissing is scary?
Him. Nothing is wrong with you. Want to come over after school Monday? Watch a movie or something?
I pause for a while before finally writing. Sure.
14.
In the parking lot before school on Monday, I told Daisy about the texting and the kissing and the 80 million microbes.
When you put it that way, kissing is actually quite disgusting, she said. On the other hand, maybe his microbes are better than yours, right? Maybe you're getting healthier.
Maybe.
Maybe you're gonna get superpowers from his microbes.
She was a normal girl until she kissed a billionaire and became
Microbianca, queen of the microbes.
I just looked at her.
I'm sorry, is that not helpful?
It'll probably get less weird, right? I said.
Like each time we kiss and nothing bad happens, it'll get less scary. I mean, it's not like he's actually going to give me Campylobacter.
And then after a second, I added, probably.
Daisy started to say something, but then she saw Michael walking toward her from across the parking lot. You'll be fine, Holmesy. See you at lunch. Love you, she said, and then took off toward Michael. She threw her arms around him and kissed him dramatically on the lips, one leg raised at the knee like she was in a movie or something.
I drove over to Davis's house straight from school. The wrought iron gates at the entrance of the driveway were closed, and I had to get out to press the intercom button.
Pickett Estate,
said a voice I recognized as Lyle's. Hi, it's Asa Holmes, Davis's friend, I said. He didn't answer, but the gate began to creak open. I got back in Harold and drove up the driveway. Lyle was sitting in his golf cart when I arrived next to the house. Hi, I said.
Davis and Noah are at the pool, he said. Can I give you a ride?
I can walk, I said.
Take the ride,
he responded flatly, gesturing to the space on the cart's bench beside him. I sat down and he set off very slowly toward the pool.
How's Davis doing?
He asked me. Good, I think.
Fragile. That's what he is. They both are.
Yeah, I said.
You gotta remember that. You ever lost somebody?
I have, I said.
Then you know,
he said as we approached the pool. Davis and Noah were sitting next to each other on the same pool lounger, both hunched forward, staring at the patio beneath them. I was thinking about Lyle saying, then you know. I didn't, not really. Every loss is unprecedented. You can't ever know someone else's hurt, not really. Just like touching someone else's body isn't the same as having someone else's body. When Davis heard the golf cart pull up, he turned his head to me, nodded, and stood up. Hi, I said.
Hey. I need a few minutes here. Sorry, something came up with Noah. Lyle, why don't you show Asa around? Show her the lab, maybe? I'll meet you there in a bit, okay?
I nodded and then got back into the golf cart. Lyle took out his cell phone.
Malik, you got a few minutes to give Davis's friend a tour? We'll be there shortly.
Lyle drove me past the golf course. asking me about my school and my grades and what my parents did for a living. I told him my mom was a teacher.
Dad's not in the picture?
He's dead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We followed a packed dirt path through a stand of trees to a rectangular glass building with a flat roof. A sign outside read laboratory. Lyle walked me to the door and opened it, but then said goodbye. The door closed behind me, and I saw Malik the zoologist leaning over a microscope. He seemed not to have heard me walk in. The room was enormous, with a long black table in the center, like the ones from chemistry class. There were cabinets beneath it, and all kinds of equipment on top of the table, including some stuff I recognized. Glass test tubes, bottles of liquids, and a lot of stuff I didn't. I walked over toward the table and looked at a circular machine with test tubes inside of it.
Sorry about that,
Malik said at last.
But these cells don't live very long outside the body, and Tua only weighs a pound and a half, so I try not to take more blood from her than necessary. That's a centrifuge.
He walked over and held up a test tube that contained what looked like blood, then placed it carefully in a rack of tubes.
So you're interested in biology?
I guess, I said. He looked at the little pool of blood in the bottom of the test tube and said,
Did you know that Tuatara can carry parasites? Tua carries Salmonella, for instance, but they never get sick from them?
I don't know much about Tuatara.
Few people do, which is a real shame because they're by far the most interesting reptile species, truly a glimpse into the distant past.
I kept looking at the Tuatara blood.
It's hard for us to even imagine how successful they've been. Tuatara have been around 1,000 times longer than humans. Just think about that. To survive as long as the Tuatara, humans would have to be in the first 0.1% of our history.
Seems unlikely, I said.
Very. Mr. Pickett loves that about Tua. How successful she is. He loves that at 40 she's probably still in the first quarter of her life.
So he leaves his whole estate to her?
I can think of worse uses for a fortune, Malik said.
I wasn't sure that I could.
But what fascinates me most, and is the focus of my research, is their molecular evolution rate. I apologize if this is boring.
In fact, I liked listening to him. He was so excited, his eyes wide like he genuinely loved his work. You don't meet a lot of grown-ups like that. No, it's interesting, I said.
Have you taken bio?
Taking it now, I said.
Okay, so you know what DNA is?
I nodded.
And you know that DNA mutates? That's what has driven the diversity of life.
Yeah, I said.
So look.
He walked over to a microscope connected to a computer and brought an image of a vaguely circular blob up on the screen.
This is a Tuatara cell. As far as we can tell, Tuatara haven't changed much in the last 200 million years, okay? They look the same as their fossils. And Tuatara do everything slowly. They mature slowly. They don't stop growing until they're 30. They reproduce slowly. They lay eggs only once every 4 years. They have a very slow metabolism. But despite doing everything slowly, and having not changed much in 200 million years, Tuatara have a faster rate of molecular mutation than any other known animal.
Like, they're evolving faster?
At a molecular level, yes. They change more rapidly than humans or lions or fruit flies. Which raises all kinds of questions. Did all animals once mutate at this rate? What happened to slow down molecular mutation? How does the animal itself change so little when its DNA is mutating so rapidly?
And do you know the answers? He laughed.
Oh, no, 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 far from it. What I love about science is that as you learn, you don't really get answers. You just get better questions.
I heard a door open behind me. Davis.
Movie?
He asked. I told Malik thanks for the tour, and he said,
Anytime. Perhaps next time you'll be ready to pet her.
I smiled. I doubt it.
Davis and I didn't hug or kiss or anything. We just walked next to each other on the dirt path for a while until he said,
"Noah got in trouble in school today."
"What happened?"
"I guess he got caught with some pot."
"Jesus, I'm sorry. Did he get arrested?"
"Oh, no, they don't involve the police with stuff like that."
I wanted to tell him the police sure as hell got involved with stuff like that at White River High School, but I stayed quiet.
"He's getting suspended, though."
It was just cold enough that I could see the air steam out of my mouth. "Maybe that'll be good for him."
"Well, he's been suspended twice before, and it hasn't helped him so far."
"I mean, who brings pot to school when they're 13? It's like he wants to get in trouble."
"I'm sorry," I said.
"He needs a dad,"
Davis said.
"Even a shitty dad. And I can't, like, I have no fucking idea what to do with him. Lyle tried to talk to him today, but Noah's just so monosyllabic.
Cool, yeah, sup, right.
I can tell he misses dad, but I can't do anything about it, you know? Lyle isn't his father. I'm not his father. Anyway, I just really needed to vent, and you're the only person I can talk to at the moment."
The only rolled over me. I could feel my palms starting to sweat. "Let's watch that movie," I said at last. Down in the theater, he said to me,
"I was trying to think of space movies you might like. This one is ridiculous, but also kind of awesome. If you don't like it, you can pick the next 10 movies we watch. Deal?"
"Sure," I said. The movie was called Jupiter Ascending, and it was both ridiculous and kind of awesome. A few minutes in, I reached over to hold his hand, and it felt okay. Nice, even. I liked his hands and the way his fingers intertwined with mine, his thumb turning little circles in the soft skin between my thumb and forefinger. As the movie reached one of its many climaxes, I giggled at something ridiculous, and he said,
"Are you enjoying this?"
And I said, "Yeah, it's silly but great." I felt like he was still looking at me, so I glanced over at him.
"I can't tell if I'm misreading this situation," he said,
and the way he was smiling made me want to kiss him so much. Holding hands felt good when it often hadn't before. So maybe this would be different now, too. I leaned over the sizable armrest between us and kissed him quickly on the lips. And I liked the warmth of his mouth. I wanted more of it. And I raised my hand to his cheek and started really kissing him now. And I could feel his mouth opening. And I just wanted to be with him like a normal person would. I wanted to feel the brain-fuzzing intimacy I'd felt when texting with him, and I liked kissing him. He was a good kisser. But then the thoughts came, and I could feel his spit alive in my mouth. I pulled away as subtly as I could manage.
"You okay?"
"Yeah," I said. "Yeah, totally. Just want to..." I was trying to think of what a normal person would say. Like maybe if I could just say and do whatever normal people say and do, then he would believe me to be one. Or maybe that I could even become one.
"Take it slow,"
he suggested.
"Yeah," I said. "Yeah, exactly."
"Cool."
He nodded toward the movie.
"I've been waiting for this scene. You'll love it. It's bonkers."
There's an Edna St. Vincent Millay poem that's been rumbling around inside me ever since I first read it. And part of it goes, "Blown from the dark hill hither to my door, three flakes, then four, arrive, then many more." You can count the first three flakes, and the fourth. Then language fails, and you have to settle in and try to survive the blizzard. So it was with the tightening spiral of my thoughts. I thought about his bacteria being inside of me. I thought about the probability that some percentage of said bacteria were malicious. I thought about the E. coli and Campylobacter and Clostridium difficile that were very likely an ongoing part of Davis's microbiota, A fourth thought arrived, then many more.
I have to go to the bathroom, I said. I'll be right back.
I emerged from the basement to find the dying light of the day shining through the windows, making the white walls look a little pink. Noah, playing a video game on the couch, said,
Aza?
I spun around and entered a bathroom. I washed my face, stared at myself in the mirror, watching myself breathe. I watched myself for a long time, trying to figure a way to shut it off, trying to find my inner monologue's mute button, trying. And then I pulled the hand sanitizer out of my jacket and squeezed a glob of it into my mouth. I gagged a little as I swished the burning slime of it around my mouth, then swallowed.
You watching Jupiter Ascending?
Noah asked as I left the bathroom.
Yeah.
Dope.
I turned to leave, but then he said,
Aza?
I walked over to him and sat next to him on the couch.
Nobody wants to find him.
Your dad, you mean?
It's like I can't think about anything else.
Do you think, like, he would really disappear and not even text us? Do you think maybe he's trying and we just haven't figured out how to listen?
I felt so bad for the kid.
Yeah, maybe, I said. Or maybe he's just waiting until it's safe.
Right, Noah said. Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks.
I was starting to stand up when he said,
But couldn't he have sent an email? They can't trace that stuff if you just use public Wi-Fi. Couldn't he have texted us from a phone he picked up somewhere?
Maybe he's scared, I said. I was trying to help, but maybe there was no helping.
Will you keep looking, though?
Yeah, I said. Yeah, sure, Noah.
He reached over to pick up his video game controller, my sign to go back downstairs. Davis had paused the movie in the midst of a starfighter battle, and the bright light from a suspended explosion was reflected in his glasses as he turned to me. I sat down next to him, and he asked,
You all right?
I'm really sorry, I said.
Is there something I should do different?
No, it has nothing to do with you. It's just, like, I can't talk about it right now.
My head was spinning, and I was trying to keep my mouth turned away from him so he wouldn't smell the hand sanitizer on my breath.
That's fine, he said. I like us. I like that we've got our own way of doing things.
You don't mean that.
I do.
I was staring at the frozen movie screen, waiting for him to unpause it.
I overheard you talking to Noah.
I could still feel his spit in my mouth, and the respite the hand sanitizer had provided was dwindling away. If I could still feel his spit, it was probably still in there. You might need to drink more of it.
This is ridiculous. Billions of people kiss and nothing bad happens to them.
You know you'll feel better if you drink more.
He needs to see somebody, I said. A psychologist or something.
He needs a father.
Why did you even try to kiss him? You should have known. You could have had a normal night, but you chose this. Right now needs to be about Noah, not me. His bacteria are swimming in you. They're on your tongue right now. Even pure alcohol can't kill them all.
Do you just want to watch the movie?
I nodded, and we sat next to each other, close but not touching, for the next hour, as the spiral tightened. 15. After I got home that night, I went to bed but not to sleep. I kept starting texts to him and then not sending them, until finally I put the phone down and took my laptop out. I was wondering what had happened to Davis's online life, where he'd gone once he shut down his social media profiles. The Google hits related to Davis were overwhelmingly about his father. Pickett Engineering CEO reveals in interview he won't leave a dime to his teenage children, etc. Davis hadn't updated his Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or blog since the disappearance, and searches for his two usernames, Dahl Goodman and Davis_NotDave02, turned up only links to other people. So I started looking for similar usernames. Dahl Goodman 02, Davis_NotDave, Davis_NotDavid, then guessing at Facebook and blog URLs. And then after more than an hour, just after midnight, it finally occurred to me to search for the phrase, "The leaves are gone, you should be too." A single link came up to a blog with the username isnotid02. The site had been created 2 months earlier, and like Davis's previous journal, most of the entries began with a quote from someone else and then concluded with a short, cryptic essay. But this site also had a tab called Poems. I clicked over to the journal and scrolled down until I reached the first entry. In three words, I can sum up everything I've learned about life. It goes on. Robert Frost.
14 days since the mess began. My life isn't worse exactly, just smaller. Look up long enough and you start to feel your infinitesimality. The difference between alive and not, that's something. But from where the stars are watching, there is almost no difference between varieties of alive, between me and the newly mown grass I'm lying on right now. We are both astonishments, the closest thing in the known universe to a miracle.
And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down. Emily Dickinson.
There are about 100 billion stars in the Milky Way. One for every person who ever lived, more or less. I was thinking about that beneath the sky tonight, unseasonably warm, as good a showing of stars as one gets around here. Something about looking up always makes me feel like I'm falling. Earlier, I heard my brother crying in his room, and I stood next to the door for a long time. And I know he knew I was there because he tried to stop sobbing when the floorboards creaked under my footstep. And I just stood out there for the longest time, staring at his door, unable to open it.
Even the silence has a story to tell you. Jacqueline Woodson.
The worst part of being truly alone is you think about all the times you wish that everyone would just leave you be. Then they do, and you are left being, and you turn out to be terrible company.
The world is a globe. The farther you sail, the closer to home you are. Terry Pratchett.
Sometimes I open Google Maps and zoom in on random places where he might be. S came by last night to walk us through what happens now. What happens if he's found? What happens if he's not? And at one point he said, "You understand that I'm referring now not to the physical person, but to the legal entity." The legal entity is what hovers over us, haunting our home. The physical person is in that map somewhere.
I am in love with the world. Maurice Sendak.
We always say that we are beneath the stars. We aren't, of course. There is no up or down. And anyway, the stars surround us. But we say we are beneath them, which is nice. So often English glorifies the human. We are whose, other animals are that's. But English puts us beneath the stars, at least. Eventually, a she showed up.
What's past is prologue. William Shakespeare.
Seeing your past, or a person from your past, can, for me at least, be physically painful. I'm overwhelmed by a melancholic ache, and I want the past back, no matter the cost.
It doesn't matter that it won't come back, that it never even actually existed as I remember it. I want it back. I want things to be like they were, or like I remember them having been. Whole. But she doesn't remind me of the past for some reason. She feels present tense.
The next entry was posted late the night he'd given me the money, and more or less confirmed that the she was me. Awake, dear heart, awake. Thou hast slept well. Awake. William Shakespeare.
I wonder if I fucked it up. But if I hadn't done it, I'd have wondered something else. Life is a series of choices between wonders.
The aisle is full of noises. William Shakespeare.
The thought, would she like me if I weren't me, is an impossible thought. It folds in upon itself. But what I mean is, would she like me if the same body and soul were transported into a different life, a lesser life? But then, of course, I wouldn't be me. I would be someone else. The past is a snare that has already caught you. A nightmare, Daedalus said, from which I am trying to awake.
And then the most recent entry. This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine. William Shakespeare.
She noted more than once that the meteor shower was happening beyond the overcast sky, even if we could not see it. Who cares if she can kiss? She can see through the clouds.
It was only after reading every journal entry that I noticed the ones about me began with quotes from The Tempest. I felt like I was invading his privacy, but it was a public blog, and spending time with his writing felt like spending time with him, only not as scary. So I clicked over to the poems section. The first one went,
"My mother's footsteps were so quiet I barely heard her leave."
Another,
"You must never let truth get in the way of beauty, or so E.E. Cummings believed. This is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart," he wrote of love and longing. That often got him laid, I'm sure, which was the poem's sole intent. But gravity differs from affection. Only one is constant.
And then the first poem, written on the same day as the first journal entry, 2 weeks after his father's disappearance.
"He carried me around my whole life, picked me up, took me here and there, said, 'Come with me, I'll take you, we'll have fun.' We never did. You don't know a father's weight until it's lifted."
As I reread the poem, my phone buzzed. Davis.
"Hi."
Me. "Hi." Him.
"Are you on my blog right now?"
Me. "Maybe. Is that okay?" Him.
"I'm just glad it's you. My analytics said someone from Indianapolis has been on the site for 30 minutes. I got nervous."
Me. "Why?" Him.
"I don't want my terrible poems published in the news."
Me. "Nobody would do that. Also, stop saying your poems are terrible." Him.
"How did you find it?"
Me. "Searched. The leaves are gone, you should be too. Nothing anyone else would know to search." Him.
"Sorry if I sound paranoid, I just like posting there and don't want to have to delete it."
Him.
"It was nice to see you tonight."
Me.
"Yeah."
I saw the dot 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 that meant he was typing.
But no words came, so after a while, I wrote him. Me. Do you want to FaceTime? Him.
Sure.
My fingers were trembling a little when I tapped the button to start a video call. His face appeared, gray in the ghost light of his phone, and I held a finger up to my mouth and whispered, "Shh." And we watched each other in silence, our barely discernible faces and bodies exposed through our screen's dim light, more intimate than I could ever be in real life. As I looked at his face looking at mine, I realized the light that made him visible to me came mostly from a cycle. Our screens were lighting each of us with light from the other's bedroom. I could only see him because he could see me. In the fear and excitement of being in front of each other in that grainy silver light, it felt like I wasn't really in my bed and he wasn't really in his. Instead, we were together in the non-sensorial place, almost like we were inside the other's consciousness, a closeness that real life with its real bodies could never match. After we hung up, he texted me.
I like us. For real.
And somehow, I believed him. And for a while, we found ways to be us, hanging out IRL occasionally, but texting and FaceTiming almost every night. We'd found a way to be on a Ferris wheel without talking about being on a Ferris wheel. Some days I fell deeper into spirals than others, but changing the Band-Aid sort of worked, and the breathing exercises and the pills and everything else sort of worked. And my life continued. I read books and did homework, took tests and watched TV with my mom, saw Daisy when she wasn't busy with Michael, read and reread that college guide and imagined the array of futures it promised. And then one night, bored and missing the days when Daisy and I spent half our lives together at Applebee's, I read her Star Wars stories. Daisy's most recent story, A Ray of Hot, had been published the week before. I was astonished to see it had been read thousands of times. Daisy was kind of famous. The story, narrated by Ray, takes place on Tatooine, where lovebirds Ray and Chewbacca have stopped off to pick up some cargo from an 8-foot-tall dude named Calkino. Chewie and Ray are accompanied by a blue-haired girl named Ayala, whom Ray describes as my best friend and greatest burden. They meet up with Calkino at a pod race, where Calkino offers the team 2 million credits to take 4 boxes of cargo to Utapau.
I've got a weird feeling about this, Ayala said.
I rolled my eyes. Ayala couldn't get anything right. And the more she worried, the worse she made everything. She had the moral integrity of a girl who'd never been hungry, always shitting on the way Chewie and I made a living without noticing that our work provided her with food and shelter. Chewie owed Ayala a life debt, because her father had died saving Chewie years ago, and Chewie was a Wookiee of principle, even when it wasn't convenient. Ayala's morals were all convenience, because easy living was the only kind of living she'd ever known. Ayala mumbled,
"This isn't right."
She reached into her mane of blue hair and plucked out a strand, then twirled it around her finger. A nervous habit, but then all her habits were nervous. I kept reading, my gut clenching as I did. Ayala was horrible. She interrupted Chewie and Ray while they were making out on board the Millennium Falcon with an annoying question about the hyperdrive that a reasonably competent 5-year-old could have figured out. She screwed up the shipment by opening one of the cargo cases, revealing power cells that shot off so much energy they almost blew up the ship. At one point, Daisy wrote, "Ayala wasn't a bad person, just a useless one."
The story ended with the triumphant delivery of the power cells. But because one had lost some of its energy when Ayala opened the box, the recipients knew our intrepid heroes had seen the cargo, and a bounty was placed on their heads. Or should I say our heads? All of which meant the stakes would be even higher in next week's story. There were dozens of comments. The most recent one was, "I love to hate Ayala. Thank you for bringing her back." Daisy had replied to that comment with, "Thanks. Thanks for reading." I read through the stories in reverse chronological order and discovered all the previous ways Ayala had ruined things for Chewie and Rey. The only time I'd ever done anything worthwhile was when, overcome by anxiety, I threw up on a hut named Yanta, creating a momentary distraction that allowed Chewie to grab a blaster and save us from certain death. I stayed up too late reading, and then later still thinking about what I'd say to Daisy the next morning, my thoughts careening between furious and scared, circling around my bedroom like a vulture. I woke up the next morning feeling wretched, not just tired, but terrified. I now saw myself as Daisy saw me, clueless, helpless, useless, less. As I drove to school, my head pounding from sleeplessness, I kept thinking about how I'd been scared of monsters as a kid. When I was little, I knew monsters weren't, like, real. But I also knew I could be hurt by things that weren't real. I knew that made-up things mattered and could kill you. I felt like that again after reading Daisy's stories. Like something invisible was coming for me. I expected the sight of Daisy to piss me off, but when I actually saw her, sitting on the steps outside school, bundled up against the cold, a gloved hand waving at me, I felt like, well, like I deserved it, really. Like Ayala was the thing Daisy had to do to live with me. She stood up as I approached. "You okay, Holmesy?" Daisy asked. I nodded. I couldn't really say anything. My throat felt tight, like I might start to cry. "What's wrong?" she asked.
"Just tired," I said.
"Holmesy, don't take this the wrong way, but you look like you just got off work from your job playing a ghoul at a haunted house, and now you're in a parking lot trying to score some meth." "I'll be sure not to take that the wrong way." She put her arm around me. "I mean, you're still gorgeous, of course. You can't ungorgeous yourself, Holmesy, no matter how hard you try. I'm just saying you need some sleep. Do some self-care, you know?" I nodded and shrugged off her embrace. "We haven't hung out in forever, just the two of us," she said. "Maybe I can come over later?" I wanted to tell her no, but I was thinking about how Ayala always said no to everything, and I didn't want to be like my fictional self.
"Sure.
Michael and I are having a homework night, but I should have about 142 minutes after school if we go straight to your house, which just happens to be the running time of Attack of the Clones." "A homework night?" I asked. Michael appeared from behind me and said,
"We're reading A Midsummer Night's Dream to each other for English."
"Seriously?"
"What?" Daisy said. "It's not my fault we're adorable. But first, Yoda lightsaber battling at your house after school. Cool?"
"Cool.
It's a date," she said. 6 hours later, we lay on the floor next to each other, bodies propped up with couch cushions, and watched Anakin Skywalker and Padme fall for each other in extremely slow motion. Daisy considered Attack of the Clones to be the most underrated Star Wars film. I thought it was kinda crap, but it was fun to watch Daisy watch it. Her mouth literally moved with each line of dialogue. I was looking at my phone mostly, scrolling through articles about Pickett's disappearance, looking for anything that might connect to joggers or a jogger's mouth. I'd meant it when I told Noah I'd keep looking. But the clues we had just didn't seem much like clues. I want to like Jar Jar because hating Jar Jar is so cliche, but he was the worst, Daisy said. I actually killed him years ago in my fic. It felt amazing. My stomach turned, but I concentrated on my phone. What are you looking at? She asked.
Just reading about the Pickett investigation, seeing if there's anything new. Noah's really screwed up about it, and I don't know. I just want to help him somehow.
Holmesy, we got the reward. It's over. Your problem is you don't know when you've won.
Yeah, I said.
I mean, Davis gave us the reward so that we would drop it. So drop it.
Yeah, okay, I said.
I knew she was right, but she didn't have to be such an asshole about it. I thought the conversation was over. But a few seconds later, she paused the movie and continued talking.
It's just, like, this isn't going to be some story where the poor penniless girl gets rich and then realizes that truth matters more than money and establishes her heroism by going back to being the poor penniless girl, okay? Everyone's life is better with Pickett disappeared. Just let it be.
No one's taking away your money, I said quietly.
I love you, Holmesy, but be smart.
Got it, I said.
Promise?
Yeah, I promise.
And we break hearts, but we don't break promises, she said.
You say that's your motto, but you spend 99% of your time with Michael now.
Except right now, I'm hanging out with you and Jar Jar Binks, she said.
We went back to watching the movie. As it ended, she squeezed my arm and said,
I love you.
Then raced off to Michael's place. Later that night, I got a text from Davis.
Him. You around?
Me.
I am. You want to FaceTime?
Him.
Could I possibly see you IRL?
Me.
I guess, but I'm less fun IRL.
Him.
I like you IRL. Is now good?
Me.
Now's good.
Him.
Dress warm. It's cold out and the sky is clear.
Harold and I drove over to the Pickett compound. He's not much for cold weather. And it seemed to me I could hear something in his engine tightening up, but he held it together for me, that blessed car. The walk from the driveway to Davis's house was frigid, even in my winter coat and mittens. You never think much about weather when it's good, but once it gets cold enough to see your breath, you can't ignore it. The weather decides when you think about it, not the other way around. As I approached, the front door opened for me. Davis was sitting on the couch next to Noah, playing their usual Starfighter video game.
Hi,
I said.
Hey,
Davis said.
Sup,
Noah added.
Listen, bud, Davis said as he stood up. I'm gonna go for a walk with Aza before she debundles. Back in a bit, cool?
He reached over and mussed Noah's hair.
Cool,
Noah said. I read Daisy's stories. I told him as we walked. The grass of the golf course was still cut perfectly short, even though the only golfer in the family had now been missing for months.
They're pretty good, right?
I guess. I was distracted by how terrible Ayala is.
She's not all bad, just anxious.
She causes 100% of the problems in the stories. He nudged his shoulder against me sweetly.
I kind of liked her, but I guess I'm biased.
We walked around the whole property until we eventually stopped at the pool. Davis tapped a button on his phone and the pool cover rolled away. We sat down on lounge chairs next to each other. And I watched the water from the pool steam into the cold air as Davis lay back to look up at the sky.
I don't understand why he's so stuck inside himself when there is this endlessness to fall into.
Who is?
Noah.
I noticed he'd reached into his coat pocket. He pulled something out and twirled it in his palm. At first, I thought it might be a pen, but then as he moved it rhythmically through his fingers, like a magician playing with cards, I realized it was the Iron Man.
"Don't judge me," he said.